members to serve openly. On February 2, 2010, the JCS chairman spoke truth to power, in the process pointing out that an institution, his institution, that placed a premium on personal integrity was forcing its members to sacrifice theirs. To me, at least, Mike's simple, direct statement made the moral obligation to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell self-evident. In the span of 29 seconds, Mike Mullen forever became a personal hero of mine, after which I would always consider lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues from the perspective he expressed that day. Simultaneous with the Fort Hood shooting investigation and the initial efforts to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I watched from the sidelines as Denny Blair's tenure as DNI began to unravel. For much of 2009, he and Leon Panetta had been in a bureaucratic spat over whether the CIA director or the DNI should designate the senior intelligence officer at a given foreign location. The whole idea of having a CIA station chief was to make a senior person cognizant of all U.S. intelligence activity taking place in the country in question, and who was in turn accountable to the diplomatic chief of mission there, typically the ambassador. This arrangement had been memorialized in an agreement between Secretary Rumsfeld and DCI Porter Goss. Denny could and did make an argument for the DNI to be able to pick someone outside CIA to be the senior officer, for instance, in a country where NSA has a larger U.S. intelligence footprint than CIA. Either way, it seemed to me to be less than a critical issue on which to draw a line in the sand, but that's where Denny chose to draw his line. Leon, for his part, was right to push back, both on principle and because in the charged atmosphere of 2009, the CIA workforce needed someone to have their back. Both public opinion and elected officials had turned against the agency over work it had carried out, work that it had been ordered by the president to do, that was deemed legal and that was approved by those briefed in Congress. And many in the CIA believed it had been critical to preventing another tragedy in the years immediately after 9/11. Particularly frustrating was the fact that the programs in question, the use of enhanced interrogation techniques and extraordinary rendition to black sites, had ended long before many in the agency were even aware of their existence. Leon was not going to acquiesce, but even those circumstances could have been worked out if he and Denny had held the argument in private. Instead, Denny issued a cable, an official communication, notifying everyone overseas that he was in charge of picking the senior intelligence officer in each station. CIA officers took that as yet another attempt to marginalize the agency and its traditional authorities abroad. Leon immediately issued a cable countermanding Denny's. Denny, in turn, appealed to the White House, essentially to determine if he was in fact in command of the intelligence community. In October, Vice President Biden brought the two men into his office to mediate their differences. Leon wasn't giving ground, and Denny wasn't disposed to mediation with someone he felt reported to him, so it was left to Biden to make the final call. Weeks later, he decided in favor of the CIA and Leon. Denny had picked his battle and lost. The situation worsened on Christmas Day 2009, when Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, a young Nigerian man aboard Northwest Airlines Flight 253 from Amsterdam to Detroit, tried to set off plastic explosives hidden in his underwear. The explosives fizzled, setting his underwear on fire. Other passengers noticed what was happening and overwhelmed him with physical force. In the weeks that followed the attempted attack, the White House identified shortcomings at the National Counterterrorism Center, made worse by NCTC Director Mike Leiter's delay in returning from a ski vacation upon learning of the attack. NCTC postured itself as independent, but Leiter worked for Denny, and when John Brennan, the founding NCTC director, pointed out NCTC's problems, it reflected poorly on Denny. In the years since 2010, people have theorized that Denny Blair didn't last as DNI because of his feud with Leon Panetta or because of the intelligence failure regarding Abdulmutallab, or because of any of his public gaffes, gaffes that we're all prone to. I simply think he was an intelligent, capable, patriotic man who was not the best fit for that particular job. He had 34 years of experience in uniform as a consumer of intelligence, leading to his command of all U.S. forces for more than half the surface of the globe. I learned later that as DNI, he'd forcefully engaged White House and National Security Council meetings with his views on how, when, and where to project force, which makes sense in the context of Denny Blair, presidential advisor. As a lifelong intelligence officer, I instinctively live by the first fundamental unwritten law of intelligence work. Speak straight, unbiased intelligence truth to power, and leave the business of policymaking to the policymakers. I've described all this here not to criticize Denny, but because his experience had an impact on decisions I would make when I succeeded him, and it influenced how I dealt with the IC leadership, particularly the three CIA directors who served during my tenure as DNI. Chapter 5. The Second Most Thankless Job in Washington. In early April 2010, with Denny Blair still on the job, Bob Gates called me to his office and said simply, "Jim, we need you to be the DNI." My immediate response was a flat no. I'd watched three successive DNIs in less than 5 years struggle with the responsibility of occupying a cabinet-level position without congruent legislative authorities. The DNI was tasked to be the president's senior advisor and to lead, integrate, and manage the consolidated budgets of 17 disparate intelligence organizations, transforming them into an actual intelligence community, but had zero line authority over any agency. I knew all too well from my time at the NEMA NGA how hard it could be to integrate different cultures, and NEMA had involved only two groups of people, both within the agency I directed. 15 of the 17 organizations for which the DNI was responsible reported to 6 cabinet departments, led by 6 cabinet secretaries, and the legislation that established the DNI included a clause granting deference to those secretaries. I wasn't sure it was possible to actually do the job of DNI. Moreover, as I told Bob then, I was pushing 70, today of course I'm dragging it closer to 80, and I had absolutely no interest in enduring another confirmation process. Most important, I'd already taken 2 post-retirement jobs with Sue barely acquiescing. I'd retired after DIA at her behest, and it seemed to me that it was again time for us to follow her wishes. That night I told her about the job offer and how I'd declined it, expecting she'd be pleased and impressed. Instead, much to my surprise and chagrin, she replied, "How could you turn that down?" Once again I found myself in a late-night conversation in which Sue tried to straighten out my priorities over a glass or two of wine. She argued that this job was fundamentally different from NGA director or undersecretary. The DNI scope was wider. I would have a chance to make a difference for the entire community, and I'd be working directly with the president. The next morning, I dropped off a note to Bob that read, "I talked to Sue and thought about it, and if you and the president think I'm the right person for the job, I'll do it." I then went back to work as USDI and heard nothing for weeks. On Tuesday, May 4th, I was on my way to Andrews Air Force Base for a flight to Ottawa to meet with my Canadian intelligence counterparts, when Robert Rangel, Bob's chief of staff, called to say I had an appointment with the president the following morning. When I told him I was on my way to Andrews to fly to Ottawa, he replied, "You don't understand. You have an appointment with the president tomorrow, alone." He explained that it would be an interview for the DNI position. I believe my entire response was, "Oh," and I canceled my trip. I arrived in the anteroom outside the Oval Office 15 minutes early. Over the next 7 years, I'd get to know that anteroom well. It wasn't much bigger than a few office cubicles, but it was a central hub with one door leading to the main entrance to the Oval, another to a hallway toward the Roosevelt Room, a third to the Cabinet Room, and a fourth leading to the President's outer office and a back entrance to the Oval. When I was finally led to the Oval Office entrance, I saw President Obama standing at a credenza in front of his scheduler's desk, casually looking over the front pages of a pile of newspapers. He looked up, gave me his patented smile, stepped over, and shook my hand. I have no doubt that his greeting was choreographed to put me at ease. I don't recall precisely what he said, but after some pleasantries, he gestured for me to follow him into the Oval, another room I would get to know very well. This wasn't my first time in the Oval Office, as earlier in my career I'd been part of a group of strap-hangers attending a personnel announcement there. But this was certainly my first time alone with a president, an experience even cabinet secretaries seldom have. It would be repeated for me twice more in the next 7 years, both times for discussions about replacements for the CIA director. I observed as I entered that the office is designed to impress and intimidate. My eyes took in the blue presidential seal, embedded directly in the center of the oval rug. Rays of gold and bronze radiated out from it across the rug and projected onto the vertically striped walls. Between my meeting in May and my first President's Daily Brief in September, President Obama would swap out the radiant rug for a solid cream-colored one with a white presidential seal. His more muted color scheme projected a still confident but more relaxed commander-in-chief, one who embraced the power of the office but equally exhibited the humility inherent in his character. At one end of the room, under three tall windows, stood the famous Resolute desk, constructed from the timbers of HMS Resolute, a British ship trapped in Arctic ice, abandoned in 1854, and then recovered and returned by Americans 2 years later. When Resolute was retired, Queen Victoria had the massive, ornate, and magnificent desk made and presented it to President Rutherford B. Hayes in 1880 as a sign of gratitude and friendship. It both symbolizes and embodies the power and grandeur of the office of the president. I rarely saw President Obama behind that desk, except during signing ceremonies and photo ops. At the other end of the room, a portrait of George Washington hung over the fireplace mantel. The president walked over to the chair to Washington's left, motioning for me to join him in the chair to Washington's right, which Oval Office etiquette typically reserved for the vice president or foreign dignitaries. He asked how I felt about taking the DNI job, letting me present my prepared talking points up front. I told him I hadn't campaigned for the job, that I was nearly 70 years old and already had one foot in assisted living, but acknowledged that I was a duty guy at heart, and if asked, I'd do my best. I felt that the DNI was an important position and a vast improvement from the DCI system, because the intelligence community leader is not a part-time job for an agency director. He chuckled at my assisted living line and said I looked as if I was in pretty good shape. He asked if I worked out, and I told him my schedule of alternating days between lifting weights and doing cardio. We talked about balancing the rigors of our jobs with taking care of ourselves and kept it light, but he was clearly taking stock of me. After about 15 minutes, he smiled, rose, shook my hand, and walked me out. The next day I visited Bob in his office and discussed the interview. I enjoyed shooting the breeze with the president, but I had more thoughts on what it would take to make the DNI job actually work that I hadn't had a chance to express. Bob suggested I write a letter to President Obama, which he would personally hand-deliver. On Thursday, May 20th, Denny Blair announced his resignation. The media hyperventilated, speculating about what had happened to prompt his removal. Many associated it with a May 18th Senate report on Abdulmutallab's Christmas Day attempt to set off explosives aboard Flight 253. Since the release of that report, I'd been rumored as Denny's replacement, and after his resignation, my face was all over the cable news networks. I sat down to finish my letter to the president, writing that I hoped my thoughts would be universally useful to him, whether I ended up as the official nominee or not. I also cautioned, I think the position of DNI has about one more chance to succeed before the Congress gets serious about trying something else, that is, a Department of Intelligence, which I think would pose major civil liberties challenges. I didn't share my experience of touring the Stasi headquarters in East Berlin, and I didn't express how strongly the idea of an all-powerful American intelligence czar went against my perception of who we were as a nation. In the 2.5 weeks since Bob had suggested I write a letter, I'd wondered about just how candid I should be. Finally, with the understanding that if I couldn't write complete truth in that letter, I would never be able to do justice for the intelligence community in the country as DNI, I decided that President Obama deserved my full candor, so I offered 7 key observations. Regarding his expectations, I wrote, if the expectation is that the DNI and the community which he/she is the nominal leader is to be held to the standard of perfection, batting 1,000 all the time, then you may want to look for someone who is far more clairvoyant than I. Too often people confuse mysteries and secrets and expect the intelligence community, IC, to be equally adept at divining both. We're not. In the minds of many in the IC, Denny Blair's departure seems to substantiate the old simplistic saw about there being only 2 conditions in public life, policy success or intelligence failure. My second point concerned defining some lanes in the road for the relationships between CIA Director Leon Panetta, Homeland Security Advisor John Brennan, and the next DNI. First and foremost in your mind, and then, of course, to them, and, importantly, for the intelligence community at large. Right now, there is confusion about who is really in charge of intelligence and what you expect of each. Further, both the optics and substance of your interactions with the DNI are crucial. If you consistently treat the DNI as your senior intelligence advisor, that in itself will empower the position. If, on the other hand, you engage directly with the director of CIA without at least the knowledge, or preferably the participation, of the DNI, the stature and imputed authority of the DNI are marginalized accordingly. Thirdly, I agreed with Bob Gates's idea that the DNI should function as something like an avuncular sage, strong Senate committee chairman, in the tradition of, say, John Warner or Sam Nunn, bringing other leaders together on the merits of an idea rather than issuing line orders. Further, I endorsed the idea that only a career intelligence officer could follow the model that Bob had set as DCI, explaining that because of his vast experience, he was a DNI way before anyone thought of it, and concluding, that, by the way, is a strength of the DNI arrangement, someone who can preside over the entire community without the distraction of running a large, complex agency. My fourth observation was that I would need to make some changes to the ODNI organizational structure and staff. My fifth was, I am a truth-to-power guy. I described the trouble that that conviction had gotten me into when I spoke my mind to the previous Secretary of Defense and noted that I wasn't going to change. I would always insist on giving you privately the facts to include what we don't know. Within that sentence, I'd deliberately chosen the adverb privately. I thought those were 5 reasonable, defensible observations. My sixth, not so much. I have always sought to be below the radar. I do not like publicity. I've spent the last week cringing every time I saw my name in the paper or my face on the tube. I think it is part of the unwritten code of professional intelligence officers to stay out of the media. I don't believe the DNI should be out making speeches, appearing on talking head shows, or giving interviews. I certainly didn't believe the DNI should ever write a memoir. Finally, I noted that if I was chosen as DNI, and if the first inklings of discomfiture with me arise, I would not be offended if asked to leave, and There should be no agonizing over such a decision. I signed it, with great respect, Jim Clapper. I never received a direct reply to the letter, although my later interactions with the president led me to believe he'd absorbed both its substance and intent. On Saturday, June 5th, I returned to the Oval Office, this time so that the president could announce my nomination. Sue and Jennifer and her family accompanied me, and President Obama laughed and kidded with them, radiating his irresistible charm and good humor, putting all of us at ease. My two oldest grandkids, Ryan and Aaron, were wide-eyed, both at meeting the president and just being in the White House. As we were walking out to the Rose Garden to face the phalanx of media cameras, the president paused and commented to Aaron, "I appreciate your grandfather's willingness to take on the second most thankless job in Washington." I thought he was joking. Nope. On Monday, I received a call from Kathleen Turner. I knew her from my time as DIA director as a sharp Soviet subject matter expert who'd risen through the ranks to become at 32 the youngest DIA officer ever to reach senior executive. I'd appointed her as DIA's human resources director, and after I moved on, she'd continued to impress in roles of increasing responsibility until, in 2005, she left DIA to serve as the first ODNI legislative affairs director. I was very happy to hear her say she'd be my Sherpa, my experienced and knowledgeable guide through the confirmation process. I was filling out volumes of paperwork from the White House, all the typical security clearance and conflict of interest forms, but also much more intrusive questions, such as what I might have ever written or said that could embarrass the president, and how I was getting along with my wife. They served as a fair warning of the public profile of the job I was about to take. I also got a call from Leon Panetta, congratulating me and inviting me to lunch with him and Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Dianne Feinstein, whom I didn't know personally and with whom I hadn't always had the most positive and satisfying exchanges during hearings. Leon wanted both to help me with my confirmation and to begin repairing the breach between the CIA and ODNI. The lunch succeeded on both counts. I didn't say much, but Leon slipped in some good words for me, reassuring Feinstein, who was skeptical of military retirees, that I'd taken off the active duty uniform 15 years earlier and left that mindset behind me. I told her that, as DNI, I'd focus on integration of community efforts, the reason I felt Congress and the president had created the position. One of the few things she said directly to me over lunch confirmed the concern I'd expressed to the president. There would probably not be another chance to make the DNI concept work if it didn't work this time. Leon helped me with one other issue that summer, something that probably contributed to my success more than any other. I told him I needed the principal deputy DNI to be a CIA person, someone who had insight into and credibility and influence with the agency, someone who could cover my blind spots when CIA issues came up. Leon offered his number three, Stephanie O'Sullivan, CIA's associate deputy director. I knew her by reputation as a brilliant technical engineer who'd spent most of her career building systems to which I often didn't have accesses. When we spoke, I told her my principal motivation in taking the DNI job was to make the enterprise better. I proposed that generally I'd work the outside, the White House, Congress, foreign partners, agency directors, if she'd work the inside, ODNI staff and intelligence community issues. This resonated with her, and we bonded right from the start. Of course, before I could put any of that into action, I had to be confirmed. Kathleen Turner guided me through meetings with each of the senators on the Intelligence Committee, who would all ask questions at my confirmation hearing and would ultimately vote on sending my name to the Senate floor. I laid out my case to each, and they all seemed to hear me out before turning to their own pet issues. Many expressed concerns about installing yet another retired military officer in a senior civilian intelligence position. I reminded them that I was one of only a few who had served as a military service intelligence chief, twice as an agency director, once in uniform and once in a suit, and as a political appointee at the undersecretary level, experience that gave me a fair understanding of what it took to make all those jobs work and that I would bring to bear as DNI. Many expressed serious doubts and warned again that I represented the last chance to get this right, but Kathleen always put a positive spin on events and, on more than one occasion, talked me down from backing out of the nomination. By far the most comfortable meeting I had was with Senator Barbara Mikulski from Maryland. We already had a rapport from working through base realignment and closure issues when I'd been NGA director. Senator Mikulski and I would both retire in January 2017, and in the 7 years I worked with her, my impression never changed. She was the rare Capitol Hill politician who always advocated for her positions, which consistently included the IC and our workforce, but never let the culture of politics compromise her fundamental sense of right. Meanwhile, the defense intelligence world didn't stop turning, and two important events occurred on my watch as USDI that summer. For several years, the Pentagon had faced the growing realization that it needed to organize for military activity in the cyber realm, both on defense and offense. In time-honored government tradition, we conducted a study while knowing the outcome we desired. Once the report was in hand, Secretary Gates ordered the establishment of U.S. Cyber Command under U.S. Strategic Command. CyberCom was to be formed at Fort Meade with NSA and led by the NSA director, since NSA was the center of expertise and had all the resources and capabilities for operating in cyberspace. Making CyberCom subordinate to StratCom and giving the NSA director another hat were intended to be temporary provisions until CyberCom could take its training wheels off and operate independently. On May 21st, Keith Alexander pinned on his fourth star and added another hat as the first CyberCom commander. Keith already had served for 5 years as NSA director, and I observed that his primary institutional instincts remained with NSA. His successor, Admiral Mike Rogers, put on both hats simultaneously, and his focus seemed to be more evenly balanced. The second notable event of that summer was the appointment of Tish Long as the third director of NGA, fifth, accounting my NEMA predecessors. I had always assumed that I'd been named the third director of NEMA in 2001 because DOD wasn't ready to name a woman, namely Joan Dempsey, as director of one of the five intelligence agencies. By 2010, we were ready, and more important, Tish was the most qualified and talented individual available to lead NGA. She'd served as the first chief information officer at DIA when I'd been director, and then had replaced Joan as the director of the GDIB staff. She'd also served as deputy director of naval intelligence and in a key leadership position with the USDI before moving to DIA as deputy director in 2006. I considered Tish a protege, and in one of life's happy coincidences, she took her oath of office as NGA director the same day I did as DNI, August 9th. That's getting a little ahead of the story. My confirmation hearing was finally scheduled for July 20th. I'm still not sure whether to consider it fortunate or unfortunate that July 20th was day two of the Washington Post series Top Secret America. The articles were a collaboration between Dana Priest and William M. Arkin. Priest had won the Pulitzer Prize for beat reporting in 2006 with her work about CIA black sites and had received acclaim again in 2007 for exposing the conditions veterans were enduring at Walter Reed. She and Arkin had spent 2 years doing research, and the Post was billing this series as her next big blockbuster. It was not. Its primary premise was that the combined U.S. counterterrorism, homeland security, and intelligence enterprise was massively bloated. It reported that 1,271 government organizations and 1,931 private companies worked in 10,000 locations across the United States, with an estimated 854,000 people holding security clearances. This revelation was met with a collective yawn. The original plan for Top Secret America was for the Post to put an interactive website online on which anyone could see Google Street Views of places that Arkin and the Post believed were intelligence sites, alleging that an undisclosed covert spy facility could be in any reader's backyard. Without confirming to the Post whether any of their assessments were correct, intelligence officials, including Denny Blair, convinced the editors that publishing those addresses would invite attacks at those locations and that the paper could be held criminally liable. The Post wisely decided not to publish actual addresses, and what they were left with was breathless reporting from Dana Priest, who recounted sitting at a table with an actual intelligence contractor, one of hundreds of thousands, according to her own reporting, and trying to access the DNI's headquarters building unannounced, prompting men in black to jump out of nowhere, guns at the ready. By the afternoon of July 19th, the first Top Secret America article had fallen to second place on the Post's website of the most read stories, behind a commentary on people not giving up their seats on the metro to people with disabilities. Day two of the series focused on how, in this huge enterprise, there were so many gosh darn contractors, people who worked for private companies hired by the government to perform jobs that it couldn't fill with federal employees. After 9/11, when national security leaders assessed what the peace dividend had wrought, they realized they would have to pay private companies to quickly reconstitute the capabilities they'd lost through downsizing. By 2010, the pendulum had not swung back far enough toward hiring government employees with the necessary skill sets, but we were well aware of that fact. In a very narrow sense, the appearance of the Post series was fortunate for me, because it made the line of questions at my confirmation hearing predictable and generally within my knowledge wheelhouse, thanks to my time as USDI. On the morning of the hearing, President Obama called to wish me luck, the first of only two direct phone calls I got from him. I told him I didn't have a feeling for how the hearing would go, and he assured me it would be fine. Sue, Jennifer, Jay, my brother Mike, and my sister Chris sat directly behind me, sending positive energy my way for the hearing and, I hoped, making the senators more reticent to publicly flog me in front of them. When it was my turn to speak, I acknowledged their support on the official Senate record, noting that I'd had Sue's for 45 years at that point, and I observed that their seats were more comfortable than my small chair behind a small table with a thin microphone jutting toward my face. The senators were on a raised dais that extended in a U-shape around me. Throughout the confirmation hearing, Senators Feinstein and Kit Bond, the senior Republican and committee vice chair, remained at the center of the dais, directing the action, while the other senators customarily took their seats only when it was their turn to ask questions, at which point the camera would cut to them. I think the morning's theme was best captured by an off-microphone comment from Bond to Feinstein that did not make it into the official record or media reporting. "Welcome to our annual DNI confirmation," which was indicative of a good bit of the cynicism held toward the very concept of the DNI, whether it could work and whether I was up to the job, particularly as they seemed to view me as too beholden to DOD. Senator Bond noted that the Armed Services Committee had endorsed me and that the Intelligence Committee didn't regard that as necessarily to my benefit. After Senator Bond's remarks, I greatly appreciated Senator Mikulski's speaking up. In an exception to protocol, she took the microphone for several minutes before my opening statement, taking Feinstein and Bond to task. "I know we've been through four DNI confirmations, four DNIs," she acknowledged, "and if there is a failure in or questions about the authority and the functionality of the DNI, then it's incumbent on Congress to look at the legislation, but not necessarily fault the DNI nominee for the failures of the legislative framework." She then preempted much of the criticism I'd received that morning with a rousing defense, which I truly appreciated. One of the things in working with Mr. Clapper as head of the NGA was, again, his candor, his straightforwardness, his willingness to tell it like it is, not the way the top brass wanted to hear it. I thought it was refreshing and enabled us to work very well. I think that in this job he will be able to speak truth to power, which God knows we need it, and he will speak truth about power, which we also need. I would hope that as we say, oh, gee, we don't know if we want a military guy chairing or heading the DNI, Mr. Clapper left the military service in 1995. He's been a civilian. He doesn't come with the whole extensive, often military staff that people bring with them when they take a civilian job. And I think in my mind he's probably the best qualified to do this job, because he's not only been a Nighthawk standing sentry over the United States of America, but he's actually run an intelligence agency, and he's actually had to run a big bureaucracy, and he's had to run with sometimes very inadequate leadership at the top. So we ought to give him a chance, and I think we ought to hear what he has to say today. None of Senator Mikulski's statement made it into the press reporting on the hearing, but a quote from Kit Bond, taken completely out of context, made it into every piece of media coverage. After a wonky exchange about comments I'd made a decade earlier that the Senate Intelligence Committee, instead of the Senate Armed Services Committee, should have authority over the military intelligence program, Senator Bond talked about the problems inherent in having the two Senate committees divide oversight duties. I wanted to respond that the 9/11 Commission had judged congressional oversight of intelligence to be dysfunctional for precisely this reason, and that while the intelligence community had worked hard to reform itself in that regard, Congress had taken no such steps. I also felt that the single best thing Congress could do to strengthen the DNI and to make post-9/11 intelligence reform successful would be to separate the National Intelligence Program from cabinet budgets and make it a self-standing appropriation. I didn't say any of that. I couldn't, and he knew it. Still, Bond pressed me to agree that his committee should take oversight of the MIP. Out of a sense of self-preservation, I declined to advocate for either of the two committees, both of which I'd be reporting to if confirmed. Bond understood and laughed. Of the fight for budget control between the two committees, he said, "You have, as anyone around here knows, entered into the most deadly minefield in Washington, D.C." All of the headlines instead referred to the DNI post itself as the most deadly minefield in Washington. I survived the hearing, and the committee advanced my name to the full Senate. Before a vote could happen, though, two committee Republicans, Bond and Tom Coburn, each put a hold on my nomination, saying they wanted the administration to give them classified reports on the dangers posed by releasing Guantanamo Bay detainees. When they released their holds the first week of August, Senator McCain put another hold on me, asking for something else with no relation to me. The Senate was scheduled to adjourn for recess on Friday, August 6th for the rest of the month, and it looked as though they would leave without voting on my appointment. National Security Advisor Jim Jones told me that if they didn't hold a vote, President Obama would make a recess appointment. I warned Jim that because the DNI's authorities were already ambiguous, an appointment without Senate confirmation would only further weaken the position. I told him that if the Senate adjourned without voting on me, I would withdraw. On Thursday night, August 5th, I attended a social event at which C-SPAN was on in the background. It was that kind of party. Well into the evening, Senator Harry Reid was presiding over votes on the floor. We watched as he called for a vote on Measure 1019, my nomination. None of the senators present, if there were any, since C-SPAN is not allowed to pan the gallery, opposed my nomination. As they moved on to the next measure, I simply shook my head and stared at the screen. Just like that, after all that drama, I'd been confirmed. On Friday, I finished packing my office in the Pentagon, and on Saturday morning I arrived at my new office at Liberty Crossing in McLean, Virginia, which everyone just calls LX, to find Brigadier General Linda R. Irusha-Varhol, General UV, my senior military assistant at USDI, and one of just two people I brought along from the Pentagon, already there with her husband, Greg, setting up my new office. The painting of a ship that had hung at my desk where I'd been the military assistant at NSA in 1972 was now behind what would be my desk as DNI. Across an embarrassingly large stretch of carpet, the portrait of General Patton given to me by the USDI staff hung beside a small circular conference table. As I watched UV and Greg lay out my other memorabilia from the past 47 years, seeing my stuff in that office suddenly made the job feel very real, much more so than had the anticlimactic confirmation vote. On Monday, August 9th, I went to see Tish sworn in as NGA director in a big formal ceremony at the new NGA headquarters building in Springfield, Virginia, the facility I'd fought so hard for in 2005. The building was still a year from being open for business, but the scale and the vision for the campus were evident, and the ceremony that morning was a proud moment for me. After the ceremony, my new security detail drove Sue and me back to Liberty Crossing, where ODNI Chief Management Officer Mark Ewing met us at the office and swore me in at an informal gathering, making me officially the DNI. I started on the job the next day with what would become my morning ritual. The protective detail picked me up at 5:45, and I began reading the overnight intelligence reporting in the back of the secure, armored SUV. I changed into workout clothes in my office and hit the small but complete gym in the basement of Liberty Crossing. My office had an adjoining shower, and once I was back in a suit, I tried to finish reading the previous night's reports. Then I met with Pat Rohan, my personal briefer for the President's Daily Brief, PDB. Star analysts normally take one-year tours as briefers, but because Pat, who had been my briefer as USDI, and I had a terrific rapport, I managed to persuade the PDB staff to let him come to Liberty Crossing. When he completed that assignment, he took a one-year rotation as my executive assistant. The PDB is the IC's daily, well, 6 days a week, dialogue with the President to address global challenges and opportunities related to national security. Its existence dates back to the Kennedy administration, and today it's among the most highly classified and sensitive documents in all of government, and perhaps one of the most expensive daily publications in the world. Although the CIA still generates the lion's share of the articles in the PDB, all 17 intelligence components can and do contribute, and then the PDB staff works with the authors to edit their writing and analysis in a grueling process that can take place over several weeks or several days, depending on the urgency of the subject. Working in shifts, the PDB staff compiles the analytic articles and graphics overnight, sometimes making edits on new information or even switching articles completely in the early morning hours. The PDB briefers assigned to National Security Cabinet members and a handful of other senior officials, like USDI, all come to CIA headquarters in the pre-dawn hours each morning. There they meet with the staff and the article's authors, read the PDB, get a briefing on the intelligence sources behind the articles, and ask any questions they think each principal they brief might ask. The process is as much a final check on the soundness of the articles and the validity of sources as a chance for the briefers to prepare. After the prep session, briefers scatter in the dark across Virginia and Washington with the PDBs, which, when I became DNI, were hard copies in faux leather loose-leaf binders. On that first Tuesday morning, after briefing with Pat, my detail took me to the White House. I met with Jim Jones and we went to the Oval for the President's PDB session. At the time, President Obama had two PDB briefers, Jim DeNoy from DIA and an analyst from CIA. Jim was the first non-CIA briefer ever assigned to the President, a distinction that isn't as curious as it sounds, since the PDB was a CIA-only operation until 2005. And I sat with him on the couch in the Oval as the President and Vice President listened to him briefly review each of the articles in that day's book. The president paid attention and nodded politely, but clearly he had already read and digested its contents. I wasn't slated to actively participate, but at one point I interjected on a topic Pat and I had discussed at length that morning. The president and I spoke for maybe 4 minutes out of a total of 8 or 9 minutes we spent with him, and as we left, Jim told me that was the most conversation he'd ever witnessed at a PDB session with the president. I was amazed and felt we clearly could do better. I wanted to address the situation right then and there, but I was already due to be in a principals committee meeting in the Situation Room about Guantanamo Bay detainees. I made a mental note and pressed on with my day, gaining a deeper appreciation of why John Negroponte, Mike McConnell, and Denny Blair felt it was hard to get things done in the post. For reference, while both the Principals Committee, PC, and National Security Council, NSC, are composed of cabinet members leading national security-related departments, PC meetings are chaired by the National Security Advisor, and NSC meetings are chaired by the President. Each took up a huge amount of my time during the next few years, both in preparing for and attending them. The National Security Council staff would typically send over a read book the night before, which I was supposed to digest and be ready to discuss the next day. Meetings almost always started with an intelligence briefing, which I led or I'd moderate, if CIA, NSA, NCTC, or any other specialized IC entity was there to brief. We'd then discuss a series of questions, always more than we could possibly get through. Early on, I grew accustomed to spending long hours with President Obama, Vice President Biden, National Security Advisor Jim Jones, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano, Attorney General Eric Holder, Homeland Security Advisor John Brennan, and Secretary of Defense Bob Gates, and their successors, often a few times a week. Over the next 6.5 years, the only NSC participants not to change were the President and Vice President. I'd see 3 National Security Advisors, 4 Defense Secretaries, 2 Secretaries of State, 2 DHS Secretaries, and 2 Attorneys General, not to mention 3 CIA Directors and Michael Morell as Acting CIA Director, twice. In Bob Gates' book, he wrote about friendly, competitive dynamics within NSC meetings, particularly his perceived rivalries with Vice President Biden and Secretary Clinton over policy decisions that affected DOD, a dynamic I can validate. But because of unwritten rule of intelligence number 1, leave the policymaking to policymakers, I never personally felt that sense of rivalry with any NSC member, including any of the CIA directors. I do think that during President Obama's second term, John Brennan and I had the model relationship for how a DNI and CIA director should work together, presenting a united front on intelligence issues, even when briefing covert actions, for which I always deferred to the CIA director. I knew what John was going to say. That was partly preparation together and also decades of experience. What we were able to accomplish reinforces why it's better to have intelligence professionals in those positions rather than politicians or military line officers. I made it a practice to stay out of the policy fray during NSC meetings, although I recall a conversation I had with the president at a PDB session the morning after a particularly contentious NSC meeting on Afghanistan. In the calm of that morning brief time, I told him that I'd served as an intelligence officer in Vietnam early in the war, and in headquarters offices as the war progressed and finally concluded. I said that the conversation at the NSC meeting had eerily reminded me of conversations as that war ground on, with the generals arguing that they just needed a few thousand more troops, a few million more dollars, a little more time, and they could win it. I explained that I wasn't advocating for a particular Afghanistan policy, but felt he should know that the language we were using was haunting to me. Irritated, he asked why, if I felt this way, I hadn't spoken up at the NSC meeting. If I'd made that observation during the NSC discussion, I replied, it would have been perceived as my weighing into the debate, and I did not want to compromise my credibility as an impartial, unbiased bearer of intelligence truth. He nodded, agreed, and said that he appreciated my bringing up my observation. Because of the nature and unrelenting frequency of NSC and PC meetings, I never felt I had to take extra steps to cultivate a kinship with the cabinet secretaries. When Susan Rice became National Security Advisor, I was one of the few people, perhaps the only person at PC meetings, who could get away with jokes at her expense. Remember that PC meetings do not include the president. I recall one Situation Room gathering during which UN Ambassador Samantha Power was participating via secure video teleconference from New York. "Hello, J-Wicks." That morning, I'd been fitted at Walter Reed Military Hospital with new hearing aids, which had Bluetooth capability. At the start of the meeting, Samantha complained that she couldn't hear my intelligence briefing very well. I quipped loudly that she should get hearing aids like my new ones and pulled out a remote control to demonstrate. "I can turn the volume down," I said, pushing a button, and then, "I can turn the volume up," pushing another, "and finally there's a special button here that just says National Security Advisor, off." I pretended to push an imaginary silence button reserved for Susan, and then I sat back and smiled, pretending I couldn't hear Susan, and then everyone else, laughing. On Wednesday, after working out and discussing the PDB with Pat, I met with the four deputy DNIs, trying to get a sense of their concerns. It was obvious that most of them had genuinely liked and respected Denny Blair, and their biggest apprehension was not knowing what would change, yet again, with their fourth director in 5 years. Having led DIA and NEMA NGA during times of transition, I developed in my own head a concentric circle approach to prioritizing relationships. I needed to focus first on making ODNI work, then on relationships with IC agency and component leaders, then on the DNI representatives across the world, representatives of foreign intelligence partners, law enforcement, and first responders at the federal, state, local, and tribal levels, and finally on the community workforce around D.C., and deployed around the world. Similarly, in my head, I had organized circles for the world external to intelligence: the White House, then Congress, the media, and finally the U.S. public. Of course, this was simply an organizing approach, and in practice I had to engage all the circles simultaneously. Reflecting back, the only relationship I could never make work consistently was the one with Congress. On Thursday of my first week as DNI, I flew with DIA Director Ron Burgess to Scott Air Force Base, Illinois, where the intelligence staff of U.S. Transportation Command was to dedicate a conference room named for me. More important, it gave me a chance to get out of Washington and talk to intelligence analysts and customers. Over the next 6.5 years, my staff consistently expressed concern for my stamina in taking as many trips as I did. But the truth was, the only way for me to recharge was to get out of the Capitol to meet with intelligence officers in the field, whose sense of mission energized me. Thinking of my concentric circles approach, I also had an ulterior motive for this trip. On the flight out, I talked with Ron about the organizational change I wanted to make within the ODNI staff, that while the law said the DNI could have 4 deputy DNIs, IRTPA didn't say that the DNI had to have that many. I intended to tell the staff that we would have only 1, the DDNI for intelligence integration. The collection and analysis organizations within ODNI would merge. Integration would be ODNI's core mission, and all other ODNI components would be integration enablers. I explained that the ideal person to fill this role was Robert Cardillo, the civilian whom Ron had sent to the JCS to fill in as the senior intelligence officer. Robert had replaced Tish Long as Ron's deputy at DIA only 2 days earlier, so I understood that moving him wouldn't be convenient. Ron, to his credit, said, "If you want Robert, you've got him." A big lesson from my DIA and NGA experience was not to leave the staff in suspense when making changes, so I announced what I called tweaks to the organization at the senior staff meeting that first Friday morning. Anticipating resistance, I said that I'd already informed the president of my decision, which was true, as I'd written about reorganizing the ODNI in the letter I'd sent him in May. There were some reservations, but no real resistance, and everyone seemed to relax and get on with business. During my second week on the job, I focused on concentric circle number 2, the leaders at the IC agencies and their components. Because I already had good relationships with the directors of NSA, NRO, NGA, and DIA, and because Leon Panetta wanted to repair the rift that had recently opened between the CIA and ODNI, I started with the CIA. Leon invited me to lunch with the agency leadership on Wednesday, at which I made it clear that while I did not intend to control their work, I did need to know what was going on in the agency. We talked a lot about presenting a united front to the White House and Congress, and in the media if necessary. This wasn't a question of getting our stories straight when in trouble. It was about being on the same page from the start. I repeated the Air Force expression I'd shared with Leon before my confirmation. If you want me around when the plane crashes, make sure I'm around when the plane takes off. The agency, to its credit, abided by that rule of thumb for my entire tenure. My formal swearing-in ceremony took place on August 24th. Some of my family had flown in for the event, and a little crowd gathered in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, about 100 feet west of the White House. Sue and I stood in the hallway, waiting on Vice President Biden to arrive to officiate at the ceremony. When he appeared, I took a couple of steps forward, preparing to shake his hand, but without making eye contact with me, he went straight to Sue, thanking her for the sacrifices she'd made, for her service, and for letting me come back to government. What a classy thing to do, I thought. In that moment, I knew that he understood how difficult life can be for families who also serve, and who often see when we're frustrated, sad, or angry, or sometimes elated, but can't always be told the reason why. Robert Cardillo became the deputy DNI for intelligence integration about a week later, and we quickly addressed the president's morning briefings. While the PDB staff had adapted the content for President Obama, we were still conducting oval briefings modeled for President Bush, who wanted to have the articles briefed in detail, absorb the material, and ask briefers questions at the same session. President Obama preferred to read and digest the material ahead of time. There was almost a mystical aura around the PDB, with people apparently reluctant to make changes to it, but I knew we could make better use of the president's precious time. Robert and I explained to him that we wanted to stop sending PDB briefers to review what he'd already read. Instead, we would present what we called walk-ons, short briefing items we'd find to supplement what was in the formal PDB book, or new intelligence reporting that had arrived during the night. We would periodically bring in subject matter expert analysts from throughout the community to discuss specific topics in depth. The president seemed to appreciate that the PDB, with its 4 to 6 articles daily, could not address the entire range of issues that confronted him, and that our approach would be a valuable supplement. He agreed, saying we need to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. I proposed that Robert and I rotate attending the briefings, explaining, "This may come as a surprise to you, Mr. President, but I don't lust for Oval Office rug time." He laughed and responded, "Me neither." Once we set that process in place, we didn't change it much over the next 6 years, except that Robert began bringing a secure iPad to play video clips and show imagery. Because President Obama was extremely comfortable with digital technology, we converted the PDB book to a digital form in 2012, after which they were delivered on secure iPads. Being old and old-fashioned, I still like to bring hard copy of maps, charts, photos, and imagery to the meetings, both to enrich the intelligence picture and show off the capabilities of the IC. Because those sessions normally included the vice president, chief of staff, national security advisor, and deputies, I'd have to bring a stack of copies of anything I wanted to present, each stack held together with a paperclip. In 2015, when President Obama came to Liberty Crossing to help us celebrate the 10th anniversary of ODNI's launch, he gave a speech to the staff, telling them with an air of modesty, "I don't know how astute a consumer of information I am, but I can tell you I sure do rely